on iHeartRadio.
Time for American at Radio, 90.3 WHPC. I'm ready for the next hour, but Heidi's looking at me kind of funny. I don't know. Are you all right? Are we good? We don't know. We'll be fine. We'll be fine.
It's fine. I just didn't have your mic on at first.
Oh, that's it. Yeah, okay.
Didn't you notice all of a sudden you could hear yourself in your headphones?
I can't hear it. Right now, my headphones are really right now nothing but like sound mufflers. The volume was apparently down and I didn't even check. I'm sorry, everyone. No, we are settled in. Everything is grand. And of course, we are getting really, really, really close to wrapping up our series on The Who. I see after this week, maybe two more to sum it up. But it takes a long time for the band to say goodbye. It took them 30 to 35 years. And they still haven't really done it because they keep coming back. That's what we're calling this last series of shows, like the goodbye series. Last week was goodbye part one. This is goodbye part two. And I mean, with the passage of time, it slowly became apparent that The Who didn't really break up or end their association with one another at all. I mean, true, they all were pursuing solo projects, and we've been focusing on them.
Only pretended to break up.
Yeah, they thought that it was a good idea. The problem is, like, each of their solo projects, which they really had basically been hanging their future on, they started to deliver diminishing returns, at least in regard to public interest. If you look at Pete Townsend's chart listings, Empty Glass was top 10. Chinese Eyes was top 40. White City was maybe top 70. And from there out, he had a hard time even breaking into the top 100. So after a while, it must have become quite obvious to the ex-band members that the Who name was a cash cow that they really couldn't ignore.
Are you saying X in quotation marks?
Yeah.
In air quotes?
Exactly. So they knew that they basically couldn't ignore the band itself. And the audience made it plain that they craved to hear the classic tunes, not their new solo project. So Pete, Roger, and John would, on occasion, regroup and play live. The first time, it was for Live Aid, a charity that generated a lot of money for the cause and renewed public interest in The Who's unique brand of classic rock. Then in 1989, they mounted a full-on tour of England and the Americas, this time with studio drummer Simon Phillips on hand. So we'll get to that today. So basically what I'm saying is that despite the band's dissolution, The Who were still very much a part of pop culture in the late 80s. So let's pick up with some stuff from Pete Townsend's solo career. Here's what he's got to say about this era. Because my solo career solidified, and I enjoyed my seeming status as a godfather of rock. I decided to do three shows for Double O, the charity I'd founded, at Brixton Academy, using a new big band based on the one from White City. That had been called Deep End, a name suggested by the swimming pool setting that was used in the movie, and I stuck with it. I took Deep End to Cannes in January 1986, to perform at the MIDEM conference for musicians and artists, putting myself before almost every leading light in the music industry. The band was the same as in Brixton, featuring David Gilmour of Pink Floyd on guitar, Simon Phillips, an amazing drummer, pretty much, I would say, maybe one of the best drummers of the past, like in rock and roll anyway, of the past like few decades, sort of like a Steve Gadd of sorts, a bit younger. Who else? Rabbit, the keyboard player, Rabbit Bundrick on keyboards. Peter Hope Evans on mouth organ. Chucho Mershon from the Eurythmics on bass. And Jody Linscott on percussion. The Kick Horns, a five-piece brass section, and Billy Nichols leading a group of backing singers, enlarged the music to the point I had wanted all those years ago with Roger. Tony Smith, who managed Phil Collins and Genesis, said it was the best show he'd ever seen. My representatives at Atlantic were excited and hoped I would take the band on tour. After years as a guitar hero, I was now a front man. I looked good, sang well, and the music, gathered from a wide range of sources as well as my songs for The Who and my solo albums, was terrific. And for once in my life, I knew when to draw the line. I told Atlantic I would take the band no further. Here is a live example of the Deep End Band from a Townsend solo album that was eventually released called Deep End Live on 90.3 WHPC.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Deep End. Thanks all for coming. Got a few surprises in store for you tonight. So top up your glasses and let's get on with the show.
Through it all, the painting names spread on the wall. You got to judge the judge.
All right. Pete sounds
thank you.
Incredible form there, doesn't he? I mean, his voice.
Thank you very much.
Massively strong, maybe stronger than it's ever been. So it's hard to believe that he was just coming out of like drug issues and everything, because he just sounds like he's at full strength. And imagine that he's, for a lot of the show with songs like that, he's not wearing a guitar. He's a front man. He's basically singing into a microphone and doing his dance moves. Must have been a bit odd, but kind of wonderful at the same time. That album was released in the summer of 1986, by the way. It was followed by a second compilation of odds and ends and demos, unreleased material. That's it, called Another Scoop, following Scoop from a couple of years previous. We don't have to worry about looking at that in particular, first of all, because it is a collection of demos, and also because we actually did cover a lot of that material when I was able to slot it in to the right time frame for as we were moving through this this series, this 43, as of now, 43 part series, which I think will wrap up at 45.
Shoo-wee.
Phew. It's been something, though. It's what a ride. I mean, this band's history is incredible. And even at this late stage in the game, while I'm condensing it, I will say this. I am doing my due diligence. I am playing through about 12 hours of live shows and demos and recordings of various releases to cull it down to about a reasonable 40 or 50 minutes of music for the radio show, picking up the best bits. I hope you would agree that I have done that. Now, again, reading from Pete's autobiography. He goes, at the Faber summer party, my Faber was Pete's publishing house. It's where he was working as an editor and putting most of his effort now into that job, because it was something that I think he was quite proud of to be doing. Because I met the poet Ted Hughes for only the second time. I was hoping to create a musical based on his story for children, The Iron Man. When I inquired about the status of the rights, I was told that they were tied up in some way by a film deal in Australia. Matthew Evans stepped in with the producer, Robert Fox, and we persuaded Ted to let me begin to develop the book for a pop musical. I started to scratch out lyrics, heavy metal, A Friend is a Friend, Man and Machine, and Over the Top. Rob Dickens, who headed Warner Brothers in the UK, pulled White City. He stopped pressing the CDs after 25,000 had been sold. It had done far better in Germany and Australia than Britain, and fairly well in the States, especially on radio. When I went to see him, he gave me a White City neck scarf, and after keeping me waiting for more than 10 minutes, "You've gone all whiter than white and squeaky clean," he said. "Your fans don't even know who you are anymore." Had they ever known? Even now, I'm still trying to find out who I am. As a result of my meeting with Rob Dickens, I decided to repudiate my contract with WEA, the UK arm of our Warner Brothers record label in the USA, for the territories outside the USA and Canada, and they were happy to release me. Simon Draper at Virgin, who had built his career, and some would argue the founding fortune, for Richard Branson, on Mike Oldfield's concept album Tubular Bells, was excited to work with me on The Iron Man. Uh-oh. The deal Virgin gave me, we signed the contract later that year in December 1986, was terrific, and I used some of the large advance to order my own powerful Synclavier system and to convert my office above the studios at the Boathouse into a new composition suite. So Pete goes hard at work making an album, a musical, based on a children's book, in short. He is easily able to recruit Roger Daltrey for the project. Probably even more easy was recruiting his brother, Simon Townsend, and his friend Billy Nichols. The surprises on the record for the cast was John Lee Hooker playing the Iron Man. And even weirder was Nina Simone as the Space Dragon.
Was strange.
Yeah, she sings a song on the album called Fast Food that is just flat out bizarre. Really, totally weird.
I was trying to figure that out.
Yeah, I mean, I remember listening to it and thinking, like, I think this is Nina Simone. This is, like, how can, that's crazy that she would do this.
Yeah, I kept on saying, the voice is so familiar, but I just can't pinpoint it.
Yeah, I decided against playing it simply because it's a long, the album kind of missed Pete's target audience, and the record sales here in America proved it. The one market that really was holding on with Pete all this time was the American market, and Iron Man is sort of the album that blew it. And even though he had a new record deal, it was sort of a shame for those involved. As he says now, this is again from Pete's autobiography, Garabit Bundrick, with whom I had not seen for nearly 4 years, had finally reemerged, and I began using him and Chucho to help with arrangements and orchestrations. Billy Nichols was working almost full-time on backing vocals and as music director in that department. I brought in Simon Phillips, the highest-paid session drummer in the world at this time, to do drum programming on the synclavier and some overdubs with real drums. When I used Bill Price as an engineer and I wanted him full-time, he charged top rates. I still hadn't settled on a cast for the album, though my wish list at the time was promising. John Lee Hooker, Lou Reed, and Nina Simone had all responded with interest. When the time came to contract star singers, I would have to pay substantial advances, royalties, and expenses to record in the UK. So as you can see, he's spending a fortune on this album with his new label. I mean, everybody is getting top dollar. The most expensive session drummer in the world. He said everybody's working with him is charging him top dollar. And Pete's working and working to come up with this.
I guess he can afford it.
Well.
And they figure he can.
Well, they weren't. They gave him the advance, and they were paying the bills, you see. Now, Atlantic eventually said that they wanted a single album instead of the double that Virgin had contracted me for. So the project of culling the songs was one that I completed with clenched teeth. I had the feeling this was a terrible mistake, but felt I had no choice. Iron Man, after 2 years' solid work, felt as though it was being set aside, and The Who were crashing back into my life yet again. Here's a track from The Iron Man. Play the track Dig from that specific album on 90.3 WHPC. Oh, I'm sorry, A Friend is a Friend is the track we're going to play. I apologize.
Now facing my friend.
A Friend is a Friend is the name of the track that's taken from the Iron Man album, or you call it soundtrack, or the musical. An album that pretty much fell through the cracks everywhere, though. He mentioned that he had spent so much money on the album and the production and the musicians and the instrumentation, including the synclavier, which he bought. And in hindsight, I could probably look back and say, well, that was all probably part of the problem. I mean, the synclavier, nowadays, it's like an expensive mistake. It's something that was happening in the 80s where all this crazy fancy production was coming together that caused a lot of that music to age very poorly by having it most of it synthesized instead of physically played. When you have a guy like Simon Phillips, it's such a drag to think that he'd be programming a drum instead of actually playing it. Because if you ever saw him play, you definitely want that instead of listen to the result of what buttons he pushed. Well, again, from Pete then, from his autobiography, goes up. Bill, my manager, told me that most American promoters that he'd spoken to thought that there was no need for a new Who album. Why spoil a good thing? The point was they wanted to get the band to go on tour, but they didn't want them to release a new album for fear that the album, now that the band, the bloom seemed to be off of the rose, that the album might actually hurt the tour.
Yeah, stick to the old stuff.
Exactly. It's a strange way to think, but it was like a new mentality. So all we had to do was tour. They predicted that The Who would be the number one ticket in 1989, overtaking Led Zeppelin, whose last tour had been in Europe in 1980. The offers for sponsorship were very good, which meant we could afford to have a larger band like the one I'd used with Deep End, which had created an immensely forceful sound, but at decibel levels less than half those produced by The Who. I was still experiencing hearing trouble, tinnitus, and occasional pressure problems, and I wanted to hang on to what I had left. So The Who then release yet another live album, posthumous to their existence as a band. They reformed to put out an album called Joined Together. It was a triple album. And like I said, this time, the drummer was the session drummer, Simon Phillips. And I will say that compared to, like last week, we played highlights from the album Who's Last, which had Kenny Jones on drums, and that album sounded very much like a paint-by-numbers effort. I hate to say it, but there's really no denying it. The album Joined Together, the band sounds incredible, absolutely stupendous. The problem is, a full two-thirds of the album is dedicated to Tommy. They redo Tommy yet again. And I've visited Tommy so far, I believe, three if not four times, in this series, the actual album, the film soundtrack, the orchestral soundtrack, and a whole variety of live versions of the songs in a whole variety of different places, including Woodstock. So to go there again would just be too redundant for the show. So I need to skip that portion of the album as it was at the time of its release, because as good as it was and as tight as the band sounded, if you didn't own any other version of Tommy, then buying Joined Together and hearing the live version would have been very impressive. It was very good. But, of course, it would never overtake the original studio album in terms of its popularity or its importance. On the remainder of the tracks, most of them recorded either at Radio City Music Hall in some cases, or some of them, as is the case with this next track, recorded at the Universal Amphitheater in Los Angeles, the band would go deep into their own catalog, playing the obvious hits like Won't Get Fooled Again, Behind Blue Eyes, which I'm going to stay away from for the same reason I'm not going to play Tommy. We've just covered them too much. But they did a live version of a song from Iron Man on that tour, which I found to be a pretty useful way of hearing the Iron Man, some of the music from it, in a different context live. On the album, it was The Who performed the song called Dig. So it was very easy for them to basically take the song, work up a live version, and put it on the album with this new big band of theirs. The album itself was released in March of 1990, called Joined Together. Here is a track from that album. As I said, a track that originally appeared on Iron Man, called Dig.
We Take a pick and a spade and cut into the ground.
Interesting marriage of Pete's solo career and The Who as a band coming together on that. And before the tour even took place, Pete had serious misgivings, again from his book. It was a couple of days later, my emotional pendulum swung yet again. And I spoke to Bill, and his manager, and I told him I couldn't go through with any tour plans. I wrote to Roger and John saying that everything had felt all right when it was hypothetical. But once I started hearing about cities, towns, and stadiums, I began to feel nauseous. My last word was that The Who were finally, completely, irrevocably over. Of course, it wasn't true. The Who tour was announced in April. I did a week of PR in New York, and the rest of the time I spent plugging Iron Man, which had been released to critics that month. Coca-Cola had shown interest in using one of the songs, A Friend is a Friend, the one we played, for a summer ad campaign. At the end of the year, 1989, this is an entrance into Pete's diary. I approached the year with mixed feelings. I let Iron Man sink so I could do the Who tour. But the tour was a triumph in many ways, most of all for the way it brought together the families of Daltrey and Townsend. Also, the Who were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame on January 18, 1990, at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York City. We were in good company. That year, other inductees included Hank Ballard, The Four Seasons, The Four Tops, The Kinks, The Platters, and Simon and Garfunkel. This was the highest honor in the rock industry, created by Jan Wenner, Ahmet Hurtigan, and other truly wise brokers in the business. Let's play one more track from that live album then that brought the band together, doing yet another song from Townsend's solo career. Since we played it once, we can hear it again. The live version recorded by The Who of the song Rough Boys on 90.3. That was a song that I didn't think I would ever hear a live version of when it was released on Townsend solo album. So there it is, though. A rather incredible strong version from the album Joined Together. If you don't have a lot of Who music, that would be an excellent package to get, because there's so much great, tight, you know, versions of the material on that live album. Now, back to Pete's autobiography called Who I Am. In my life, of course, the idea of retirement was purely wishful. The decadence poignantly imagined rather than acted out, but the inner world of self-doubt was all too familiar. Very soon afterwards, I started working on songs for my new solo album that would eventually become Psycho Derelict. The album began to take shape musically in summer 1991 and was due for delivery to Virgin in July. The reworked story, and reworked, was loosely placed in the setting of my years of lonely exile 10 years before, in my house at Cleve. It was the biography of a rock star, the reptile I had fantasized about, a retired rock star who enters into a disastrous email-based relationship with a young female fan, which was actually a reporter posing as a young female fan. It wasn't meant to be about me or my life, but I wanted to introduce the world to the character type that I knew most intimately. The bleak themes of what was first called the Glass Household, eventually becoming Psycho Derelict, depravity, solipsism, retirement, disappearance, privacy, loneliness, alienation, weren't new ones for me. However, this fictional scenario that I wrote in March 1991 would have a creepy parallel with real events in my life a decade later. I'll get to that in a second. In the story, the rock star's redemption from isolation was triggered by an investigative journalist who intercepted his email and set him up to look like a pedophile. Faced with this devastating attack on his character, the rock star was forced to engage the larger world and fight. In real life, it would be through the work of one particular investigative journalist that I would manage to achieve some kind of closure after being similarly accused.
Crazy.
Right? With Iron Man, I'd overworked the songs so they sometimes came across without enough edge, my point earlier, and seemed almost lightweight. With the new songs set against the dark story of Glass Household, I felt I was really getting the balance right. I don't think the public got it, but it was a very interesting album. You could get it in two ways, one with all of the dialogue and another one with just the music. I could not play it with the dialogue. It's much too ridden with a lot of words that I'm not supposed to be playing on the radio. But the story, in short, is this. Ruth, who was a rock critic and a pop music reporter, sends a letter to the main character posing as a 15-year-old girl who dreams of being a star. She includes in her letter an erotic Polaroid of herself lying naked on her mother's grave at the age of 12. The rock star responds to her immediately, calling the photograph stunning, and telling her that they both share complicated problems. Basically, in the long run, what ends up happening is he gets exposed. The critic exposes him, and then she becomes very famous. There's new interest in his career because of all the controversy. He becomes famous again. Not exactly the way that it worked out for Pete, but like you said, a rather strange parallel of sorts. From the album, here's like the opening track that tells the story about the main character whose name was Ray. The song is called English Boy on 90.3 WHPC.
But you're just trying to test me. I'm bored with the bigger. She promises to train me, but just attempts to restrain me. I am an English boy, sassily made. You can pin me down, I am not afraid. Show no fear, I will serve with joy. I'm proud to be here, an English boy. Use me like a headline, cut pieces to pieces. I'm black on the tube line, red on the touchline. Freezing up a future, stopping every stopwatch. You see, we're moving like an oil slick, thicker than a house brick. I'm an English boy, I was brought up right. If you raise your dress, then I will bite. My voice is clear, I got perfect voice. To be down here with all the English boys. And I don't know where I am now or where I'm gonna go. I keep going round and round on the circle line like some demanding kind of commuter trying to avoid.
right, as this is playing, I'm going to just talk about the album just a little bit because it's very interesting what the reaction was. And when the album came out, some fans embraced it, thinking that it was maybe the best concept album that Pete Townshend had made as a solo artist. Well, other bands thought it was like one of the most pretentious things they'd ever heard. Like even pretentious for Pete Townshend, who's certainly one of the most pretentious rock and roll songwriters ever. As it is, it remains Pete's final solo album of all original material. He has not released one since this came out, and that was back in June of 1993. Considerable amount of time ago. 26 years, come to think of it. That's insane. So, that track, by the way, was called Let's Get Pretentious, which we just heard with I Don't Know Much. Interestingly, this track that's playing underneath me is aimed directly at his own history, called Outlive the Dinosaur. And we'll follow that up with bits of the track Now and Then, at least until our time runs out. Thanks, everybody. Have a great weekend. Enjoy this. Enjoy your time. And we'll see you next week. Bye-bye. In real
what's in your mind. I met your eyes and I was hypnotized. I let our lives become entwined. Now and then you see your soul and you're born and you can't do a thing about it. Now and then you see your soul and you're born and you can't do a thing about it. I feel so badly, darling, all the time. I have tortured you so long, but I'm helpless in this pantomime. I am aware that I was wrong. Now and then you see your soul and you're born and you can't do a thing about it.
Can't do a thing about it.
Now and then you see your soul and you're born and you can't do a thing about it.
Can't do a thing about it.
Now and then you see your soul and you're born and you can't.
Enough.
I thought we'd love and then you turn the page. I'd have to suffer your rebuff. And it was me who had the most to gain, despite the fact that I never had lost.
About it.